Chapter 36. The Tocsin of a Higher Hope. This year, standing on the verge of the 20th century, has sounded the tocsin of a higher hope. Mary Baker Eddy, 1899. The advertisement for Science and Health, which appeared weekly in the Sentinel, stated, quote, "Revised and Enlarged, 1894, end quote. That difficult year of erecting the Mother Church had also seen a revision of the textbook. The remaining years of the decade had witnessed the unceasing activity and accomplishments of the founder as she endeavored to complete her wondrous 19th century mission on this earth. 1895 was the year her church was converted to a school by the ordination of Science and Health and the Bible as its only pastors on this planet. 95 also saw the first edition of the manual and the publication of Pulpit and Press. In the first month of 1896, the founder had transferred her copyrights to Calvin Fry, and many more months of 1896 were devoted to the preparation of Miscellaneous Writings, which was published early in 1897. The Publishing Society Deed of Trust and the Board of Lectureship were both established in January of 1898. The Weekly was launched in September of that year, and November saw the famous, quote, Class of 70, end quote. In January of 1899, the Massachusetts Metaphysical College had been reopened as the Board of Education, and soon thereafter, the Publication Committee was established to counteract slanderous attacks. 1899 was frequently referred to as the closing year of the century, and in this year, the mother did all she could to strengthen her students and to solidify her church. But she did not forget her son, George Glover. Before summer, she commissioned one of her students, Mr. Charles M. Howe of St. Joseph, Missouri, to act in her behalf in providing a gift for her son and his family. So during the summer and fall, Howe was supervising the erection of a commodious 11-room brick residence in Lead City, South Dakota. But while the construction was going on, the mother, back in Concord, was being bombarded by false charges from Josephine Woodbury and her attorney, Frederick W. Peabody, who was as vitriolic as was his client, in vilifying and endeavoring to discredit the discoverer and founder of Christian Science. Peabody had filed suits for Mrs. Woodbury in both New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and Mrs. Eddy did not feel satisfied with any of the Boston attorneys her students had recommended. She needed the best counsel available to represent her, and she needed to know now who that was. Once again, she called her Minuteman, Edward Bates, to Pleasant View. Mr. Bates had learned to act quickly, as he recorded in his reminiscences. Mrs. Eddy had many times told us, quote, "If you have anything to do, do it quickly, before the error gets hold of it and stops you," end quote. And we always tried to work on that plan. I recall one time she asked me why I put a certain lady on an important committee. I said, "Because she is a good healer and a good scientist." She said, "I have no use for her. I once told her to do something which was very important, which should have been done at once. She was a whole year doing it. That is not the way to demonstrate Christian Science." The leader asked Mr. Bates if he could name a Boston attorney competent to handle her case, but he could not, being little acquainted with Boston lawyers. Mrs. Eddy knew that Edward had good business judgment and would act quickly. So when he volunteered to find the right man for her, she gave him the commission. In Edward's words, "I quietly made inquiries, the result of which was that I was satisfied that the Honorable Samuel J. Elder was a superior lawyer, universally conceded to be the Dean of the Massachusetts Bar, and he was the man to carry her case intelligently. I wrote her to this effect, and she engaged Mr. Elder as her counsel." Mrs. Eddy's friend, General Streeter, was her attorney in Concord, and as the case grew, two other able lawyers were employed in her behalf, Charles W. Bartlett and William A. Morse. The latter, though a competent attorney, had a drinking problem, and came one evening in a state of inebriety to Pleasant View, much to the consternation of the household member, who turned him away. Mrs. Eddy happened to be looking out the window as Morris was making his unsteady departure. She immediately sent for him and saw that he was lovingly cared for and helped that night. In the morning, after a good night's sleep, he left with a clear head and an unwavering devotion to Mrs. Eddy. By fall, the Sentinel had its cover design. Science and Health was in its 172nd edition, and the manual would soon be in its 13th edition. Scarcely a week went by without some circumstance that required a change in or addition to the manual. A letter in the summer of 1899 from Calvin Fry to William B. Johnson tells Mrs. Eddy's thoughts regarding individual versus group activity. "Mother requests that Article 1, Section 5 be amended by asserting after the word trustees the words, quote, nor syndicates, end quote. She says the students had better mingle with other people than form syndicates, but better still would it be for them if they would keep apart from all worldly schemes and work with God." When published in the manual, the bylaw read, "No trusteeships, nor syndicates." Section 5. "No board of trustees nor syndicates shall ever be formed by or between the members of this church, or shall exist in the Mother Church, except the trusteeship be constituted by the pastor emeritus." This bylaw is now Section 8 of Article 1, and though the wording is changed, the meaning is not. October saw malicious mind running rampant in the world. It began with another attack by Mark Twain on the discoverer and founder of Christian Science in the October Cosmopolitan magazine. And before the middle of the month, one Christian nation had attacked another Christian people when Great Britain, on October 12th, declared war on the Boers of South Africa. While Mrs. Eddy was responding to Twain's attack through the columns of the New York Herald, Miscellany, page 302, Judge Hanna was fearful that they might be faced with another lawsuit, this time from Sabin. But the calumniator maliciously attacking the Christian Scientists was not Oliver Sabin, but Josephine Woodbury. To the church officials, Mrs. Woodbury was a wicked troublemaker who frightened them somewhat. but to the leader, she was as Judas, the willing victim of malicious mind, with a sad future before her. Nonetheless, in the fall of 1899, Mrs. Woodbury's efforts were something to contend with, for she was constantly feeding the press with sensational and scandalous charges against Mrs. Eddy and Christian Science. All lies. The truth about Christian Science was stated by Judge Ewing in a beautiful testimony at the Wednesday evening meeting of the Mother Church on October 4th. After preliminary remarks about the phenomenal growth of Christian Science in the past 3 years, he went on to say, "It has been a matter of special interest to me to see the wonderful demonstrations which have been made, and the most marvelous are usually found in the smallest places. It is where two or three are gathered together in His name that the wonderful work is done. This is the argument that we have presented to men and must present to the world, knowing that the one thing of most interest for you and me and all God's children is to make these demonstrations speak for themselves and say to every doubting man and woman, as Jesus said to John, 'The lame do walk, and the blind do see.' I have taken great pains to investigate and talk with the persons who have been the objects of some of these wonderful cures, and to talk with the person who has treated them, so that I might be able to say in some sense that I had a personal knowledge of the cases. It has been a longing of mine to be able to go through as nearly as I could the whole catalog of human ills as they are presented to human sense, and I have almost accomplished that, so that almost every phase of sorrow, suffering, and heartbreak I have seen cured. For a long while, I knew I could say that the lame walk. I had seen so many instances of that kind. I wanted to be able to say, quote, 'The blind do see,' end quote. I knew where very defective eyes were cured, but I wanted to find an instance where blindness had been total or for a long term of years, so that no one could say that it was not a real, genuine instance of blindness. I wanted to see it perfectly healed. I had the pleasure within the last 6 weeks of seeing just such a case. I met a young woman, 22 years of age, at a dinner party of scientists in a little town in Nebraska. And as I looked across the table at her, I could not help saying, 'Your life has been a long holiday. You know no sorrow or tears.' But within 15 minutes, I learned that if I had taken the combined sorrows of all the people at that table, they would not have equaled a tithe of what she had suffered. I learned from her mother that she had been born with defective eyes, one large and one small, and the sight drawn to one side. At the age of 6 months, a curtain dropped down over her eyes so as to obscure the iris. No one knows whether she ever did see. At 6 years of age, she was sent to an asylum for the blind and remained there 12 years and was then sent home because she had reached the age limit of the institution. 18 months before she was discharged, her mother became interested in Christian Science and took class instruction and is now the first reader in the church there and of course her thought was very naturally addressed to her child, and she gave her all the help she could. But there was not the slightest evidence that the treatment had accomplished anything, except in the cheer of the patient. She felt that she would yet see. After she came home, a neighboring scientist began to treat her. And about 15 months after she came home, this cloud just simply disappeared. It did not roll up or down, but went out into nothingness. And that girl today sees as well as any man or woman in this house. She said that God had been very good to her in that he had made the large eye smaller and the small eye larger, so that they were both perfectly balanced. She is now a perfect specimen of vigorous young womanhood. This is the kind of demonstration that speaks for Christian Science and enables us to use with absolute knowledge of the facts the argument of Christ, quote, "The lame walk and the blind do see," end quote. The next night, Thursday, October 5th, was the date set for the semi-annual lecture under the auspices of the Mother Church. Because the number expected to attend far exceeded the seating capacity of the Mother Church, Tremont Temple was engaged for the occasion, and Judge Ewing was the lecturer. He spoke to a crowded house, and his lecture was as inspiring as his testimony had been the night before. He was the man of the hour to uphold the leader and her cause. After an unexpected visit with Mrs. Eddy in Concord, Ewing wrote of it to his wife. "She embraced and kissed me most affectionately and said, 'Oh, my dear student, I cannot speak my gratitude. Others have done valiantly, but you have spoken with more wisdom, judgment, and law than all the others.' And as usual, I said nothing except a blubber or two." In the Sentinel for November 2nd, a new church rule was published. Church Rule: "It shall be the privilege of all the leading churches of Christ Scientist situated in our largest populated cities or in the capital cities of the United States, Canada, or Great Britain, in addition to their other established lecturers, to call on Judge William G. Ewing of Chicago, Illinois, for an annual lecture under the regulations and auspices of the Mother Church in Boston. Also, with the consent of Judge Ewing, the Church shall publish his entire lecture in at least one of the leading local newspapers." Edward A. Kimball continued to be a strong voice on the lecture platform. Even though he often spoke for 2 hours, one newspaper in reporting his lecture had stated that he, quote, "so interested the audience that they appeared loath to go even when he had finished," end quote. In the fall of 1899, the leader was delegating responsibility for the continuance of her work, and she had another mission for Mr. Kimball, quite different from the one just assigned to Judge Ewing, and of even greater importance. She called Mr. Kimball to Pleasant View to discuss this sacred trust on the 7th of October. The previous day, October 6th, Calvin Fry had transferred the copyrights, which he had held since January 12, 1896, back to Mrs. Eddy, and 2 days later, she entered into a contract with Mr. Kimball. The Sentinel for October 19th carried the following notice. Assignment of copyright. An assignment of all right, title, and interest of Mrs. Mary Baker G. Eddy of Concord, New Hampshire, in and to the copyright of all her books, to Mr. Edward A. Kimball, is of record in the office of the Librarian of Congress in Washington, D.C. In the same issue of the Sentinel, Mrs. Eddy published, quote, a correction, end quote, to the previously published answer to the question, quote, if all matter is unreal, why do we deny the existence of disease in the material body, and not the body itself? End quote. Miscellany, page 217. 4 days earlier, the New York World had published an extensive interview with Josephine Woodbury, which was only one of many. She and Peabody were trying her case in the newspapers, as Hannah stated in a letter to Mrs. Eddy at the end of October. Woodbury and her attorney are continuing to try their case in the newspapers, and in a conversation with Mr. Elder yesterday, he said that a number of lawyers had spoken to him about the gross impropriety of Peabody's action, and they are contemplating bringing his case before the Bar Association. Mr. Elder's view is to take no notice of it in the newspapers, but give them rope, and then, later on, bring the whole proceeding to the attention of the court. W. and her attorney are rapidly uncovering themselves and disgusting more and more decent and thinking people. But Mrs. Woodbury continued to influence the unthinking majority. The following is an example of but one of the numerous falsehoods being sown broadcast. On the 4th of November, the New York World published a sensational dispatch from Philadelphia regarding the death of a Christian Scientist named Morgan, which stated in part, quote, finally, he became so bad that Mrs. Eddy came on from Boston and called at the Morgan house. She remained for several days praying for Morgan's recovery. There was no improvement, however. End quote. Upon being notified of their mistake, the World published a correction, but that did not stop the story. For many years, a note at the end of the preface in Science and Health had stated, quote, the author takes no patients and declines medical consultation, end quote. Beginning on November 16th, the editorial page of each issue of the Sentinel began, Mrs. Eddy does not receive patients. The author of the Christian Science textbook takes no patients, does not consult on disease, nor read letters referring to these subjects. Also in the November 16th Sentinel, the Morgan story was reported and corrected under the heading, quote, a falsehood corrected, end quote. Colonel Sabin then reprinted this correction in his newsletter alongside the story from the Philadelphia Times, adding the statement, quote, it will be noted that the above denial does not deny that she was at Philadelphia, end quote. This necessitated another more specific denial in the Sentinel, and later in December, a letter from Mrs. Morgan in Germantown, Pennsylvania was printed, which said in part, on reading the Sentinel of December 7, 1899, I was greatly grieved to find that there is still any questioning about Mrs. Eddy being in Germantown, and perhaps when they learn from my own pen that what was reported in the Philadelphia Times and other papers is an utter falsehood, they will be satisfied. But the ripples from the lie continued. In January, the Register in New Haven, Connecticut, published an apology stating that the story from the New York World, which they had published the day before, had been corrected by the World and pronounced untrue, but it was still on its travels ahead of the denial, and this falsehood was only one of many. In December, action was brought against Mrs. Woodbury for contempt of court. The judge, Judge Braley, had been strongly prejudiced against Christian Science, convinced that scientists were an erratic, deluded, unreliable people, and had had a battle with his conscience before deciding to act as judge on the case. But the exemplary behavior of the scientists and their sincerity of purpose had impressed him and helped to nullify this prejudice. On December 28th, Josephine Woodbury was found guilty, fined, and warned to cease using the newspapers to influence her suit. An interesting incident that occurred in the courtroom that day has been recorded. When Mrs. Woodbury left the trial table to go to the witness stand, she fixed her eyes upon those of the judge and kept them fixed as she advanced step by step. With a peculiar expression on his face, the judge rose from his seat and moved back a step or two to the utter astonishment of a young attorney who was in the courtroom. The young lawyer, Rosemary Anderson, had been sharing a dinner table with Judge Braley at the United States Hotel during her stay in Boston, and could not help remarking about the incident at dinner that evening. After a surprised look, the judge said to her, "I am going to tell you something peculiar. I never had such a strange experience in my life before. As that woman started to come forward, I felt just as though a snake were coming toward me, but I did not know that I left my seat." Articles less traceable to their source continued to appear in the press that were unfavorable to Mrs. Eddy and favorable to Mrs. Woodbury. However, only the Boston students, plus Mrs. Eddy's helpers, seemed much perturbed by them. Most of the students were involved with their own problems or church activities. On the last day of November, which was Thanksgiving Day in 1899, Mrs. Eddy sent to Mrs. Stetson in New York a benediction for the cornerstone of First Church in that city. To Mrs. A. E. Stetson, "Beneath this cornerstone, in this silent, sacred sanctuary of earth's sweet songs, paeans of praise and records of omnipotence, I leave my name with thine in unity and love. Mary Baker G. Eddy." That same day, in the presence of 1,000 Christian Scientists, Mrs. Stetson laid the cornerstone for their magnificent new temple, which was to seat 2,500 people. The event was reported in the Sentinel of December 7th, and that issue also carried a notice, which must have reflected an immediate decision of the leader, for it was tipped in before the first page and read, "Board of Education. The time for the opening of the Massachusetts Metaphysical College has been postponed until June 1900. Therefore, there will be no session of the Board of Education in January next, as heretofore announced. Further notice of this change will be given in our next issue. A later issue stated that the term would open on Wednesday following the second Tuesday of June, AD 1900. As the year drew to a close, the mother inserted an interesting card in the Sentinel of December 21st. A card. Beloved, I ask this favor of all Christian Scientists. Do not send to me on before or after the forthcoming holidays aught material except 3 tea jackets. All may contribute to these. One learns to value material things only as one needs them, and the costliest things are those that one needs least. Among my present needs material are these jackets, 2 of darkish, heavy silk, the shade appropriate to white hair, 3rd of thick satin, lighter shade but sufficiently somber. Numbers 1 and 2 to be common sense jackets for mother to work in, and not over-trimmed by any means. Number 3 for best, such as she can afford for her drawing room. Mary Baker Eddy. There was far more in this message than the students saw. Was the mother looking for material tea jackets or a spiritualized thought at this Christmastide that might accompany the gift? There is no evidence that she found what she was looking for or that any student turned to God to help provide a perfect tea jacket. A card from the mother written on Christmas Day stated simply, Beloved, I accept most gratefully your purpose to clothe me, and when God has clothed you sufficiently, he will make it easy for you to clothe one of his little ones. Give yourselves no more trouble to get the 3 garments called for by me through last week's Sentinel. The mother had given a gift to a nation the day before, when she had received Frau Gunther Peterson at Pleasant View. Many years earlier, she had said to a German man who was one of her early students, quote, Germany will be the first European nation to accept Christian Science. Their love of God, their profound religious character, their deep faith and strong intellectual qualities make them particularly receptive to Christian Science. End quote. Bertha Gunther Peterson, scholarly daughter of an eminent physician, had noted the healing of a friend, had procured science and health, and experienced healing herself. Since that time, she had studied in America and returned to Hanover, Germany to practice, being the first German practitioner listed in the journal. Now she bore the good news that the Christian Science Church in Hanover was the first non-state church ever to be granted a charter by the empire. At the close of their interview, the mother tenderly blessed Frau Gunther Peterson and her work. This student never forgot the leader's parting words. Quote, I look upon the German nation as one of the chief supporters of Christian Science. End quote. While her first German disciple was visiting at Pleasant View on the 24th of December, Charles M. Howe was representing the mother in Lead City, South Dakota, officiating at the presentation ceremonies of Mrs. Eddy's Christmas gift to her son. The following is from the Lead City Call. "One of the most elegant and beautiful gifts ever made in this city was from Reverend Mary B. G. Eddy of Concord, New Hampshire, to George W. Glover of this city. The gift consists of a handsome brick mansion at the head of Main Street, thoroughly equipped and furnished from cellar to garret. The beautiful residence is located where it commands a most extensive view of the city. Mr. Glover's friends, and we may say all the good people of this city, are much pleased over his good fortune. Mrs. Eddy is a very philanthropic lady, and her charitable work each year amounts to about $100,000. The founder's true charitable work was her great gift of Christian Science to the world. This wondrous gift, this 19th century phenomena, was the marvel of the centuries and represented a lifetime of toil and sacrifice. The alarm bell of a higher hope had been sounding loudly throughout this year, but as 1899 turned to 1900, the founder felt that she had completed her mission. In January of the new year, she wrote and published in the Sentinel, "Satisfied. It matters not what be thy lot, so love doth guide. For storm or shine, pure peace is thine, whate'er betide. And of these stones or tyrants' thrones, God able is to raise up seed in thought and deed to faithful his. I, darkling sense, arise, go hence. Our God is good. False fears are foes. Truth tatters those when understood. Love looseth thee and lifteth me ayont hate's thrall. There life is light and wisdom might, and God is all. The centuries break, the earthbound wake. God's glorified, who doth his will, his likeness still is satisfied."